Hi, I'm Dan Slepian, an investigative producer for Dateline. I hope you're already following my new podcast, Letters from Sing Sing. It's a story that started in 2002 with a single letter from an incarcerated man claiming his innocence. 20 years later, it's still unfolding. You're about to hear a clip from the third episode, where JJ, the man convicted of murder, discovers from his prison cell that detectives had identified a different primary suspect before JJ's name ever came up. If you like the clip, you can hear the rest of the episode and others right now. Just search for Letters from Sing Sing wherever you're listening and make sure to follow the podcast. When I first met JJ Velasquez in 2002, he'd been in prison for 3 years, serving 25 to life. That meant he wouldn't be eligible for parole until he was 48, and getting parole is never a guarantee. It was possible JJ could spend the rest of his life behind bars. I saw how JJ lived, locked away in his 7x9-foot cell. He told me when he was first sent upstate, he fell into the routine of prison life, sleeping in his cell, hanging out in the prison yard.
I was going through a lot of pain, and for a long time, I was private about my matters. But after a while, I realized I can't hold this in, man. I gotta let this go. When individuals started to find out that I was innocent, they said, yo, what are you doing in the yard playing basketball or softball? You need to be in a law library. Nobody's gonna get you out of prison. You need to learn the law. You need to tell the lawyers what needs to happen in your case. No one cares about you. You're not a concern. The only way you're gonna get out is if you get yourself out.
So JJ told me he started to take matters into his own hands. He'd been assigned new court-appointed attorneys to help with his appeal, but he said he had trouble getting their attention.
No attorney ever came to see me. Anytime I wrote them about my case file, they said they hadn't received it yet. I was getting nowhere. And meanwhile, I'm sitting upstate. So I had to tell the appellate division that I wanted to proceed pro se, which means that I was going to handle my own case just to get my case file. The truth of the matter is that I realized that the only person who was going to advocate for me the way that I needed was me. I got my case file September 2000, and it was a big box, probably coming up to a little bit over my knee, big and wide, and on the label it said it was 66 pounds. It was really hard to get it inside the cell because the door only opens up for so much. But I finally got it in, and it just fit, like with a little nudge, it just fit underneath the bed. That's how high the box was. So I pushed that underneath the bed. And for days, I sat on my bed and I just kept pulling out file after file after file. And I mean, there were papers on the floor. There were papers on my bed. There was even a cardboard that I put on top of my toilet so I don't have to smell it. And there was paper on there. Like, it was paper everywhere in my cell. And, you know, I was trying to keep everything neat and organized so I wouldn't misplace anything because it was just so much paper. I remember, like, falling asleep with pages of paper on me and finding it, like, casted on the floor, like, in the middle of the night. And then if I wake up in the middle of the night, next thing you know, the light is back on and I'm reading the paper again until I fall asleep. It was like I was on this expedition, seeking the truth, trying to find my way out and saying, this box is the magic. It has to be in here. Something in here is going to help me.
It wasn't long before JJ made a big discovery in that box.
It really blew my mind. I mean, I don't even know if it was bold on the page, but that's like how it stuck out to me.
It turns out that in the days right after the murder of Al Ward, the police had been focused on a different suspect, someone named Mustafa.
Never was Mustafa mentioned during my trial. Never was I informed that there was a previous suspect, an initial suspect. They knew who they were looking for. How did I wind up here?
I'm Dan Slepian, and this is Letters from Sing Sing. Episode 3, Eyewitnesses. Early on in my investigation, JJ sent me copies of everything that was in that box. And like him, I was surprised by what I read. A lot of information that JJ's jury never heard. Especially that detectives had been searching for another suspect before JJ's name was ever mentioned. This is what I learned from the police reports in JJ's case file. On January 27, 1998, the day of Al Ward's murder, a sketch of the gunman was made based on eyewitness accounts. It showed a light-skinned black man with braids, and it was posted all over Harlem. There was a huge push to find the shooter. Officers detained and questioned more than 150 people. Police showed them the sketch of the gunman to see if anyone recognized him. Tips started coming in, and one name kept coming up. One person said the guy in the sketch was someone named Mustafa. He didn't give a last name. Then another said he heard that it was Mustafa who shot a guy at the number spot. He said Mustafa sold drugs near there, that he was a black man with dreadlocks. There was also a handwritten note in the police files that mentioned the name Mustafa. Detectives seemed to take this lead seriously. I reviewed pages and pages of computer searches they'd done, looking for anyone who'd been arrested using the name Mustafa. There was even a memo sent to police headquarters declaring that Mustafa was their, quote, primary target. But the search for Mustafa came to an abrupt end 3 days after the crime, when the key eyewitness Augustus Brown picked out a picture of someone else, John Adrian Velasquez. After JJ was arrested, his lawyers asked the court to assign a private investigator to their team. The idea was to follow up on any leads the police may have missed or that might point to JJ's innocence. This happens all the time in criminal cases where a defendant can't afford an investigator. A judge granted the request and appointed a private investigator named David Barrett to help JJ. But when I first visited JJ and started learning about his case, he told me that David Barrett never did an investigation. JJ said Barrett never even spoke with him. I found this hard to believe. I mean, here's a guy charged with the murder of a retired police officer. He's claiming he's innocent, that he knows nothing about the crime. Could it be true that his own investigator never looked into anything? So I tracked down Barrett. He's handled hundreds of cases like JJ's over the years.
Ah, hello, how are you?
We met outside NBC's offices at Rockefeller Plaza in Midtown Manhattan, and he shared his thoughts about JJ's case.
The key in this case is just its identification. The moment they had that one identification, one guy after all this stuff, they stopped. You can see from their point of view, they go, look, our job is to give you probable cause. You've got probable cause. You've got identification. We're finished. We've got the man.
So isn't this where Barrett should come in? Shouldn't he do a full investigation to see what the police may have missed? Barrett says that's usually how it works. But in this case, he says JJ's lawyers didn't give him much to do.
I really was not asked to do anything particularly extensive, and I didn't have the names of these fellows who made the identification and all the rest of it. So, for instance, I never saw the sketch of this fellow or never heard of Mustafa.
It seemed crazy to me that the investigator hired to look into JJ's case never even heard about Mustafa or even received the names of the key eyewitnesses. Barrett blamed JJ's lawyers. But he also says this happens all the time when it comes to court-appointed investigations. It's baked into the system.
The state government doesn't pay very much. In those days, there used to be a $300 limit, which is absurd. If it's one trip to someplace for 2 hours, you can do it. But if it's any kind of work, you can't.
And taking one trip, it turns out, is all Barrett says he did on this case. He went to visit the crime scene.
I went to the location. I was trying to find the people who are somehow connected to the gambling spot. The truth is, I didn't really have names or anything. I just had the idea that if somebody was there, they would have some recollection of what happened.
But he says he didn't find anyone and wasn't asked to do anything else. Based on what I'd read, there was a lot to investigate. But here was JJ's investigator telling me he didn't really do anything and JJ's lawyers never gave him much to work with. I had so many questions. So I decided to call up JJ's lead trial lawyer, Frank Gould.
Yes. Hi, is this Franklin? Mr. Gould?
Yes, Frank.
Hi, this is Dan Slepian, a producer with Dateline NBC here in New York. I'm calling you about a case that you tried 10 years ago. I'm doing a story about one of your former clients by the name of John Adrian Velasquez. Remember John Adrian?
No. I don't think it was me.
Yeah, it was... It happened up in Harlem in New York City. The defendant's name was John Adrian Velasquez.
Don't remember it. Sorry.
So, it doesn't ring a bell at all?
If I can help him, I'd be glad to try.
There was a reason that Frank Gould probably didn't remember JJ or his case. I later learned from his former law partner that he'd been diagnosed with dementia. He's since passed away. I should note that I've spoken with many people in New York's legal circles, and all pretty much say that Frank Gould was a great defense attorney. Okay, one thing I now knew for sure, JJ had never gotten a proper investigation. I needed to do what David Barrett never did, actually investigate JJ's case. In the summer of 2009, 10 years after Al Ward's murder, I began looking for the person who first linked JJ to the crime, the key eyewitness, Augustus Brown. Remember, JJ told me that at his trial, Brown said he was being forced to testify. I found out Brown was at the Elmira Correctional Facility, a maximum security prison in upstate New York. He'd been locked up on a forgery charge. The prison is about a five-hour drive from New York City. I wasn't sure Brown would talk to me, so I decided to show up without giving him advance notice. I'd made arrangements with the prison to bring in my recording equipment, just in case.
That's all he knows, he'll walk over and...
When I arrive at the prison, I'm brought to a conference room. Then Brown appears. It's clear he's hesitant to speak, much less on camera. But I want to be sure to document whatever it is he tells me. So I make a split-second decision and take a small camera out of my pocket. I put it on a shelf right behind the table and hit the red button. And then, before I ask any questions, I take a minute to tell him why I'm here.
We need to get your story down, make sure we're right. We don't ever want to be wrong, and I never want to attribute anything to anybody that's not correct. It's my job to make sure that everything we say is true and correct. What I'm trying to do is trying to find the truth. That's all I'm trying to do. Here's a guy who's making a fairly compelling case that he might actually be innocent, that he may not have done anything. If that's not true, if he's the guy, I want to know it. If he's not the guy, he has two little kids that are waiting for him to get out. And by the way, even if he's innocent, he still may never get out.
So did you just want me to tell you my side?
Yeah, I just want to know if, yeah.
I don't even know where to start.
Brown tells me what he remembers from the day of the murder, how the two robbers got into a fight with the owner from the number spot, Al Ward.
One of the dudes was about to try to do something. That's when the old man jumped up. You know what I mean? And they started tussling. And then the other dude come from the back. But while they tussling, they standing over me.
Right.
Then I hear shots. And they run out. That was the first time I seen somebody killed. You know what I mean?
Brown says he took off. He didn't wait for the police to arrive. But they found him a few days later, dealing on the street. He had 10 bags of heroin stashed in his underwear. Detectives brought him into the precinct. Brown says they put the heroin on a table in front of him as they began to question him. And he says they threatened to charge him in connection with the murder if he didn't cooperate.
They threatened to charge me with conspiracy to this, saying that I set this up for them to come in and rob it. Then me having that on my record, they, young black man, I ain't got no job, I'm not in school enough.
Right.
They was going to lock me up.
And they were yelling at you?
Yeah, they was manhandling me.
Can you guess how many hours? Do you remember?
I know I ain't get out of there till like in the morning time, like 1, 2 in the morning.
Brown was at the precinct for hours. I reviewed the police report. During the time he was there, it turns out he looked at more than 1,800 mugshots before he picked out JJ's.
You know, tired. I mean, scared to death. Like, I mean, like, damn, I ain't even have nothing to do with it. And that's how the whole thing came about, me pointing the finger at him. But I don't know if it was him or not, you know what I mean?
When you picked him out, did you feel at that moment, I know this is not the guy?
Now, that's something I've been struggling with. Like, I don't know if I really picked out the right person. I don't know if it was really him. You know what I mean? Like, I really can't say, like, to myself, I just said I hope I picked the right person, I mean, but the doubts was there, too.
You had to make a decision. If you were sitting in a courtroom testifying, would you say you just don't know, or would you say you got the wrong guy, or he is the right guy?
I'd say I don't know if he's the right guy or not.
If he's the wrong guy, why him?
Brown says he picked out JJ's photo because he was scared, but also because he thought JJ looked familiar. He says he might have seen him before when he was dealing on the streets.
You never seen nobody and you said to yourself, why do I know this person from?
Right. But you remember thinking that there in that room.
Yeah. Like I've seen him before.
But not from the number spot.
Nah.
Augustus Brown, the eyewitness who brought JJ into this investigation in the first place, just admitted he didn't see JJ in the number spot. That would mean JJ wasn't the shooter, that Brown had picked out the wrong man.
You remember what time of night you ended up picking out?
It was dark. I know it was late.
And you were like, and in your mind, you were like, I'm just out of here?
Yeah. Tired. Scared, you know what I mean? That's the main thing I was scared. Like, I can't go to jail for something I didn't do.
Brown says that once he picked JJ's picture, he was allowed to go home. He wasn't charged with anything. He even got to leave with his 10 bags of heroin.
They really let you keep the heroin?
Yeah.
As I was sitting there across from Brown, I thought about what JJ had told me. That strange conversation that he said he'd had with Brown in the holding cell behind the courtroom. Brown said the story was true. He did say to JJ, they're making me do it.
What did that mean, they're making you do it?
Man, they forcing me. It was either that or go to jail.
They're forcing me, meaning they're forcing me to testify or they're forcing me to pick somebody out?
The whole process.
In fact, the prosecutors had Brown jailed in the days before the trial to make sure that he would take the stand. And once he gave his testimony, he was released. As I walked out of the prison that day, my mind was reeling. JJ's case was based entirely on eyewitness accounts. There was no DNA, no physical or forensic evidence. And now the key eyewitness, the guy who initially linked JJ to the crime, was basically saying he picked him out at random. That the detectives working the case pressured him to make an ID. And that prosecutors made him testify in court. I reached out to the NYPD and to the individual detectives who investigated the case, as well as the prosecutors who took JJ to trial. None would speak with me on the record. But there were still more leads to follow. More people to talk to. And what I just heard felt so big, I couldn't keep this information to myself. For more of this incredible story and other episodes in this podcast, go to the link in the description of this clip or search Letters from Sing Sing and follow the podcast. I hope you do.